Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Let me ask you a question. Do these pants make my butt look fat? We've all heard that, haven't we? And we know, especially we husbands, we know there is only one correct answer to that question. But is it the truth? How many times have you told little lies? How many times do you lie every single day? Let's put it in constitutional terms. Can the government make lying illegal? Even if no money changes hands, even if there is no fraud perpetrated, even if there is no defamation of character, can the government penalize you for giving the only correct answer to a question, even if it's not truthful? What if it's a more important question? What if it's a question like, did you serve in the military? Were you in the war? Did you win any medals? That's our topic today. Stolen valor. What do we do, if anything? What does the Constitution let us do about the frauds, the pretenders out there who claim to be great heroes, who claim to have won medals when many of them have never been in the military at all? This is a subject of great controversy in our nation. It's the subject of a relatively new federal statute, a federal statute that is currently being considered by the United States Supreme Court. And here with us today are two people, maybe even three if we have time, who have very different impressions of this, very different opinions of this subject. We're going to start with a lawyer from the First Amendment Center in Nashville. His name is Ken Paulson. We'll follow him up with a discussion followed by the name of Mark Seavey from the American Legion, and possibly a third lawyer as well, if we have time, who wrote a very interesting story or a very interesting piece in the New York Times recently. Let's start with Ken Paulson.
I am the president of the First Amendment Center, which is a public policy center at Vanderbilt University and at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. We're a nonpartisan organization, educational organization, that essentially exists to remind Americans that the five freedoms of the First Amendment are what truly make this nation special, and we should be vigilant about protecting those rights.
Well, I'm so pleased that you're associated with the Newseum. I've actually been there for a presentation or two, and that is a really first-rate outfit. And so we really appreciate your coming and sharing your perspective with us. The subject today is the so-called Stolen Valor Act, and I understand that you have an opinion on whether that's a constitutional exercise of Congress's power.
Of course, in the end, my opinion matters much less than the opinion of the nine Supreme Court justices.
That's something I frequently tell my students. My opinion is my opinion. That's about all it is.
Yeah, they've got the big guns in Washington, and there are nine who are about to decide the fate of a 2006 federal law that made it a crime to claim falsely to have been awarded military medals. The case stems from a man who claimed all kinds of things, but including having been recognized with the highest honors the military affords. And, you know, it turns out not to be true. And the question is, can the U.S. government punish lies about being awarded military honors? My personal concerns about this case stem from the fact that, you know, Americans historically have always had a constitutional right to lie. As unpleasant as that sounds, the truth is that lying is commonplace in American society, and you have to you have to ask yourself, do we really want to give our government the right to monitor the truth or falsity of what we have to say and then be able to punish it if they decide it's false? This is new terrain. And, you know, it does, I joke about people lying all the time, but it's true. I mean, I think there are white lies, there are self-aggrandizing lies, there are self-serving lies, but, you know, go to any high school reunion and you're going to hear plenty of them.
I just went to one of my own recently. I know exactly what you mean, but let me play devil's advocate here, though. Certainly people lie all the time with impunity, and most of them are not criminal offenses, but on the other hand, some lies are penalized. I can't go and lie to people and commit fraud, for example, or I can't lie about people and hurt their reputation in that regard. So aren't some lies already actionable?
And that is precisely the point. This law is unnecessary, and where it extends punishment is it doesn't require somebody to benefit from their lie. So, yes, there are laws, state and federal, that prohibit you from lying to defraud someone. You can't be a con artist and steal money from people. You can't claim something that's untrue in a plot to deprive people of their property. Those laws are on the books. What makes this a dangerous law is that it doesn't require you benefit from it. If you sit at the VFW bar and brag about receiving the Medal of Honor, you could be punished under this. We all agree that if somebody says, I won the Medal of Honor, and I'm facing hard times, and I think you need to start a charity or a foundation to help me and others, and if you would just write a check for me for $10,000, I, an American hero, will get through this rough time. Clearly punishable. Lying about your military experience in order to make a buck deceitfully. Clearly a crime. But this one says, if you just say it, you can be punished. And that is a startling advancement of the law, and in my view, not in a positive way. And the appellate court struck it down as clearly unconstitutional. But now that we've heard the Supreme Court arguments, it appears that this U.S. Supreme Court may well uphold this unprecedented act.
Well, before we get to looking into our crystal balls too deeply, let me just, again, play devil's advocate. If I'm sitting at the VFW and I get in my cups and I decide I'm going to claim that I've won a couple of medals of honor or done other heroic things, I'm doing it for a reason, and I'm getting some kind of benefit from it, presumably. I mean, isn't it implicit that I'm getting the benefit in terms of the admiration of my peers, or maybe even getting voted to be the next club president, or maybe in a slightly different context, I'm enhancing my resume so that maybe somebody will vote for me for the city council? I mean, aren't there forms of non-monetary benefit that are implicit in such a lie that we should be able to punish?
Well, if we're going to give government the right to punish us for being deceitful, for lying, for exaggerating, if we gain nothing but the admiration of our fellow man and woman, well, then you're going to have a lot of people, doesn't that open the door to prosecution for somebody who lies about their job, who lies about their experience, just to impress somebody at a cocktail party? Where's that? That's not such a leap, then, to say that, you know, when you tell other people lies and to make yourself look better, to make yourself feel better, that's prosecutable. That just seems to me to be a stretch, whereas somebody who clearly gets a monetary benefit could be punished.
Well, what about harm? To take a slightly different tack, you know, we publish defamatory speech because that harms other people's reputation. If I'm telling lies about my military service, doesn't that harm the reputations of people who actually are heroes, who actually did get military medals?
Well, that's what the government is arguing. It's not arguing per se that the reputation of those who won it has been damaged in any way, but it's saying that the honor has been diluted.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the strongest government argument, and that's the one that has found the most resonance at the U.S. Supreme Court. The government argues that, you know, if you don't know who really won one, then it becomes much less of an incentive to, I suppose, perform with valor on the battlefield. And there's some insult to the military in there. You know, the suggestion that if other people are running around who didn't win it, that somehow it affects people's motivation and morale. These people are selfless, heroic, tremendous military figures who deserve the awards they win. I think that the fact that some clown in, you know, somewhere in America is bragging about an award he didn't win, I don't see the connection. I do not see that it does anything. But it's an isolated incident. Now, having said that, here's what really happens. People claim to have the Medal of Honor all the time, all over this country. And we know that because there's been news coverage of them when they've been found out.
Mm-hmm.
The system works. I mean, people who lie about receiving top military honors are eventually checked out, especially in a data-driven society. And then a newspaper writes about them, and then the television station sends somebody out to interview them. And they are thoroughly humbled and humiliated. And that sends a clear signal to the American public about you shouldn't be lying about your military honors. I think that takes care of business. It resolves things in a really positive way. You can't run for public office and claim to have the Medal of Honor and not have it. People will find that out.
That would be bad, I think.
Yeah.
That would be bad for everybody. Well, to take your side for the moment here, in fact, it's often been said, perhaps you remember exactly who said it, is that the remedy for bad speech is not less speech, it's more speech.
Right.
And you know, it seems to me that one of the better suggestions I've heard on your side of the argument is simply that if the government is concerned about this, then it should have a very clear, easy-to-access website that it maintains and updates regularly, listing people who actually do have these medals, and it would be very, very easy for everybody to check these things out.
If there is a governmental interest in ferreting out false claims of medals of honor and other significant awards, either you would do that, or nobody wants to grow government any larger, but you could put somebody behind a desk in Washington, D.C. who you could check with when somebody made the claim. I mean, there are a lot of vehicles, and infringing, I don't want to say infringing, limiting existing First Amendment freedoms doesn't seem to me to be the right way to go.
Is it fair to say that you're worried about the precedent that this statute will set if it's affirmed, and that it'll be difficult to draw a line then for future similar statutes?
I am concerned about it, in part because the single most important decision concerning a free press in America is called New York Times v. Sullivan, and that has to do with untruthful content published in an ad, inaccurate content published in an ad, a law enforcement officer, a sheriff in Montgomery, Alabama, felt defamed him. And this was a critically important case that made the point that untruthful statements made in the pursuit of greater truth and part of the public dialogue could be protected under the First Amendment. Now, it's not a short, it's not a quick connection between Stolen Valor Act and New York Times v. Sullivan, but it makes us nervous to have people talk about the relative value of false statements. And I think that false statements made in public that do not amount to fraud should be protected. Government has no business policing truth or falsity.
Well, it's often been said that the First Amendment requires some breathing space, and perhaps in the public debate, and I think that's consistent with what you're saying, is that we tolerate a fair amount of untruthful speech, or at least inaccurate speech, simply because we don't want to chill the protected, important speech that's going on there.
Exactly right.
Well, anything else about the Stolen Valor Act?
Well, we're going to see the Supreme Court rule very shortly. The arguments in the court suggested that they probably will uphold this law.
Really? What do you think the vote will be?
You know, that I never play that game because I'm never, ever, ever right. But what appeared to be going on is that they responded. At one point, the attorney challenging the law was asked whether there was anything about this statute that could potentially chill truthful speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, he didn't think so. And
that was a remarkable moment.
Yeah, a lot of legal scholars are going, why don't you shoot yourself in the other foot? It was not a good moment for those who want to see this law struck down. Now, it was probably an honest response, a candid response. But the greater concern here is not about chilling truthful speech. It's about giving government the right you know, to gauge the truth or falsity of speech, and we don't want the government to be in that business. I think what is very likely to happen here is that the Supreme Court will find a way to uphold the Stolen Valor Act and will interpret it in the most narrow way possible. There's been some speculation that they will, in fact, find an implied requirement of defrauding, that even though the law doesn't spell that out, the government has claimed it, you know, it's really only going after people who defraud others with this.
Mm-hmm.
So in their decision, they could kind of fix the law by saying, clearly it's intended to do the following, and under those circumstances, we're going to uphold it. And, you know, we just think they probably will. And we have a concern about that. Now, First Amendment Center doesn't lobby, doesn't litigate, and we don't really take sides on these issues. What we do is talk about the potential impact on the First Amendment. And in this case, if the Stolen Valor Act is upheld, our collective free speech rights will have been diminished a bit. And frankly, I don't think that's worth it.
Well, Ken Paulson, President and CEO of the First Amendment Center, we thank you very much for your time and for your very valuable opinions on the Stolen Valor Act. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye. You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we're discussing the Stolen Valor Act. Is it constitutional for Congress to prohibit us from lying about our military exploits, about the medals we didn't win? Thanks very much to Ken Paulson from the First Amendment Center for talking to us about that. Let's take a moment now and have our Madison Minute.
Dolly Madison was born into a Quaker family in Guilford County, North Carolina, on May 20th, 1768, making her 17 years younger than her husband, James. While James was shy and soft-spoken, Dolly was outgoing and gregarious. She helped define social life in the new federal city by hosting famous Wednesday night parties, parties so well attended that they were dubbed squeezes. Indeed, Dolly was so popular and so renowned as a hostess that Charles Pinckney, upon losing the 1808 presidential election to James Madison, bemoaned, "I was beaten by Mr. and Mrs. Madison." Even in death, Dolly Madison was beloved by those who had known her warmth and vitality. She was the first presidential wife to be called the First Lady. President Zachary Taylor coined the term in her eulogy, delivered in July of 1849, before the largest state funeral procession ever assembled. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we're talking about the Stolen Valor Act. We heard from Ken Paulson of the First Amendment Center. After the break, we'll come and talk to Mark Seavey from the American Legion. Stay tuned. Time once again for Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier, our quiz lady. How are you, Kelly?
I'm doing great today.
Tremendous. Do you have some hard questions today?
You know, I'm always ready to challenge the audience. Now, I think last time we talked, we said we need to get pens and paper out for our listening
yes,
audience.
Yes, we do. Everyone needs to get pens and paper out because these are tough quizzes. In fact, I've heard many people say you're a challenging woman.
I try to keep it challenging.
Well, indeed you do. Well, who do we have on the line today?
My name is Ryan.
Ryan, where are you from, Ryan?
From a small town of Red Lion, Pennsylvania.
Red Lion?
Yes.
Red Lion, spelled L-I-O-N?
Yes.
That's an interesting
name. What's the history of that?
I don't know. I mean, there is a constitutional case out there about Red Lion.
Huh. There is?
Really?
Yes.
But I want to know, was there really a Red Lion?
Yeah.
I believe they ordered the wrong color uniforms, and they just called them the Red Lions, I guess. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, that was a good history lesson. What was the constitutional case from Red Lion, Pennsylvania?
It was Red Lion versus, I believe it was like the FCC.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just, they were broadcasting things that people didn't want, and it got challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Huh. First Amendment case?
Yes, it was.
Well, that's
interesting. I feel like we have a ringer today on the phone.
Yeah, he
probably... I may have to skip the quiz I have for him and find something harder.
Well, I don't know. He deserves it. If we got a First Amendment question, we'll give it to him. He's apparently an expert. Okay, Ryan, are you ready for a tough question?
I'll try my best.
All right, Ryan, I do have a First Amendment question for
Great.
You. Are you ready?
Oh, all right.
All right. The wording of the First Amendment specifies that A, Congress must not establish a religion nor prohibit its free exercise. B, neither state nor federal legislatures may establish a religion. C, the free exercise of religion shall not be infringed under any circumstance whatsoever. Or D, Congress must place a wall of separation between church and state.
Okay, that was a mouthful. So can we go through those one by one, please, Kelly?
Sure thing. The First Amendment specifies that A, Congress must not establish a religion nor prohibit its free exercise. B.
Okay, hold on.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right. We got to help Ryan out here. Ryan, what do you think about A?
A is a possibility.
So A is a possibility. All right. Well, what was B, Kelly?
B, neither state nor federal legislatures may establish a religion.
Neither state.
I feel like that's a little watered down of A. I feel like A better than that.
Watered down. We don't like watered down First Amendments. All right. What was C, Kelly?
C, the free exercise of religion shall not be infringed under any circumstance whatsoever.
Seems a little too absolutist.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that. I really am, because that, generally speaking, a pretty good indicator that something's not correct. I don't want to give it away, but I have to point that out. That's a very good point to make. Very few absolutes in the law. Okay, and Kelly, what was D?
D is Congress must place a wall of separation between church and state.
I've heard that phrase before.
Yeah.
Is that what the First Amendment says?
I would have to go with A.
Why not D? What's the wall of separation?
The absolute thing again, the must, kind of red herring, I guess.
I don't know if it said must. Did it say
it
must?
It did. It says Congress must.
Oh, must. Yeah, okay.
Ryan,
okay,
Ryan
just for the absolute.
I told you, we have a little ringer here.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, is that your final answer? A is your final answer?
I'm going to go with A.
And what was A again, Kelly?
Congress must... Oh, there's another must,
There's another
Ryan.
Must,
you know,
Ryan.
I don't know, Ryan. Don't know. You may have to rethink your answer here. Congress must not establish religion nor prohibit its free exercise.
I thought you were smart, Ryan.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we don't have a ringer.
I don't know. You still like...
You might have to go back to Red Lion and put something red on.
What was A again? Just read it off the whole thing so we can... What was it?
Congress must not establish religion nor prohibit its free exercise.
Okay. So despite that absolute statement, you still like A or not?
Let's switch to D.
Oh, Stuart, we're being hard on Ryan.
I'm not. I just want to make sure he's sure. So,
all right, so let me read D again. So A was Congress must not establish a religion nor prohibit its free exercise. D is Congress must place a wall of separation between church and state. That's a tough one.
Yeah, I'll go with D.
Final answer?
Final answer.
Kelly?
Oh, Ryan, you should have stuck with A.
Oh, no.
I feel so bad. But I tell you what, we did this with the one listener one other time. If you could tell us what the third amendment is.
Wait a second. You're bringing something. Okay. First of all, let's explain why
sure.
It's not correct. The First Amendment does say, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the very first line in the First Amendment. So that's why... A is the best answer, even though one might criticize it for using that nasty word must. Okay,
yeah.
You know, sometimes you just have to choose the best answer, even if it's not perfect. D mentions the wall of separation between church and state, but here's the kicker. That phrase appears nowhere in the Constitution. Now, it's a very important phrase. It actually appears in a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist Association. It's been incorporated by the Supreme Court into lots of First Amendment jurisprudence, and so there are many people who say that that is what the First Amendment means today. There are others who say it doesn't, because the phrase doesn't actually appear in the First Amendment. So that was a good answer, too, and shows you have some knowledge of the First Amendment, but that's the reason it's incorrect, is because that phrase doesn't actually appear in there.
Okay. But.
Kelly.
Kelly's insisting that we give people a second chance. She has a favorite question.
My favorite question. If you can tell us what the Third Amendment is of the Constitution, you will get a T-shirt.
I'll just throw it out. The quartering of soldiers.
There we go!
It's not as obscure as we thought. Okay, Ryan, you saved yourself.
This is going to be area is going to be the only listening area in the country that knows what the Third Amendment is.
Now, we have listeners all over the world. We've been picking up people who have been listening in. Wayne was in Berlin recently on the HD channel.
That's
and
great.
We've got downloads in China and Australia.
Wonderful.
So everyone will know about the Third Amendment. Well, that's just tremendous. Well, Ryan, congratulations. You have a T-shirt for your correct answer on the Third Amendment question.
Right.
And we thank you very much for playing today.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about the constitutionality of the Stolen Valor Act, a federal statute that makes it a felony to lie about your military decorations. We've already spoken to Ken Paulson from the First Amendment Center. Now let's talk to someone from the American Legion. His name is Mark Seavey.
One of the things that we've been tracking here as the war on terror goes on is we've really seen an uptick in the number of individuals who are claiming to be combat veterans of both Iraq and Afghanistan. And this has a number of implications for the rest of us. Not the least of which is that within the veterans community, you know, we try to look out for our wounded brothers and sisters and things of that nature. And some of these phonies have been really cutting into our ability to both raise funds and to appropriately allocate them. For instance, we've had a gentleman, Rick Strandloff, out in Colorado, who had started up his own veterans organization and was raising funds before it completely disintegrated and everyone found out that he had actually been seeking mental help at the time that he'd claimed to be in the Battle of Fallujah. We have other individuals who have managed to work their way onto like NRA hunting events and things of that nature that were specifically allocated for veterans of the war on terror, and it turns out that these people had just entirely fraudulently concocted these resumes. When you have these guys out there, they're both building their own personal sense of entitlement through these stories, and they're taking away from those of us that actually did serve, who want to get out there and speak about our experiences and talk about the good things that the military has done. But, you know, we're a little less eager to do that when we're surrounded by all these phonies telling their stories.
And you have actually seen combat, haven't you?
Yeah, I have a combat infantry badge from Afghanistan, and I'm actually headed back to Afghanistan next week as an embedded reporter so that I can try to get to some of these real combat veterans to get their stories out there so that people back here in the United States understand that, you know, there certainly are trials and tribulations that all the troops go through, but there's a lot of positive that's being done as well, and it's not just, you know, what the media is going to portray as far as guys with PTSD, guys and girls with PTSD coming back and having problems readjusting. There's a lot of positive that goes on over there, and we'd like to tell their story.
Well, we certainly thank you for your service, and I note that upon your return, you've actually come back and taken a different direction. You've gotten a Juris Doctorate, haven't you?
Yeah, actually, it was even worse than that. I went to law school for 2 years, and then found out that a National Guard unit nearby was going to Afghanistan, so I immediately dropped out of my second year of law school, despite the fact that I only had a month to go before taking my exams, but I dropped out right then. I went overseas, and then when I returned, I finished up my law degree and went on to take the bar exam and so forth. But
Wait a second. Now, many of my law students complain about law school, but I don't know that any of them would have preferred combat to law school.
I think, you know, it's always the grass is greener on the other side. When I was in law school, I wanted to be in the Army, and when I was in the Army, it was sort of an interesting story. At one point, I was going out on patrol, and I was carrying a bunch of stuff, and I realized that I didn't have any room in my pack, and so I took my stuff out and realized that I was carrying some law books around with me into the High Kush. I had a book on evidence law, and I thought, you know, this is really ridiculous that I'm out here carrying around an evidence law book through the mountains.
That's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when I was there, when I was in Afghanistan, I decided, you know, I started my law degree, and I'm going to finish it. But it just seemed that if this is going to be the defining moment of our generation, which I clearly think it is, that, you know, it was incumbent upon me to go out there and to do my part and try to contribute as much as I could.
Well, now, as a lawyer, though, are you at all concerned about the First Amendment implications of this statute? I mean, I understand the justifications here, but as I'm sure you know, soldiers often tell war stories. Soldiers often,
sure,
you know, the stories do tend to get better each time they're retold, and maybe the soldier's own heroism or his competence or whatever tends to get more and more emphasized with each retelling. Is that what we're talking about penalizing with this statute?
Well, there's a lot of people who think that's the case, and I don't begrudge those people that view that, and there is certainly a hyperbolic tendency among virtually everyone in the world. The thing, though, is that the Stolen Valor Act specifically applies only to specific cases where a person basically maliciously claims to have been a recipient of a medal they were not authorized. So this isn't a soldier who received a certain award and he's embellishing it where 10 enemy becomes 30. This is a case where it's a readily identifiable fact that can be easily ascertained. Now, whether someone was brave or something, that would obviously be an opinion. However, whether one is a recipient of the combat infantryman's badge is something that's easily noted, and it's not susceptible to the vagaries of interpretation. I know full well I have a combat infantryman's badge, and the reason I know that is because it's documented on my paperwork. The same is true for people who have received higher awards, whether it be the Silver Star, the Medal of Honor, or a Purple Heart. These things are laid down, so they're not. It's not an opinion. You can't say, as an opinion, I received the Purple Heart when you didn't. It's a readily identifiable fact. And I think that's what differentiates it. And certainly I think that that people are being honest when they say they worry about what sort of chilling effect or what effect it'll have on the First Amendment. But I went to the Supreme Court hearing on the Alvarez case, and when the Supreme Court justices asked the defense attorney there, the public defender, he could come up with nothing that was chilling. And in the time since then,
let's pause and talk about that concept. That's extremely important.
Sure.
I'm glad you brought up that moment in the debate. Generally speaking, when the government tries to regulate speech, even if it's justified and even if it's a narrowly targeted regulation, there's always a concern that the regulation, the existence of the regulation, will chill, that it'll induce people not to speak speech that is protected. And
right.
So that's something the justices are always going to ask. You know, if we uphold this law, is there going to be protected speech that someone's going to be afraid to talk about? And the advocate against this said, no, he couldn't think of a single thing. And I believe it was Justice Kagan who then said, that's a huge admission, and it was.
Right. Yeah, and he had actually said, Your Honor, it's not that it may necessarily chill any truthful speech. I mean, we certainly concede that one typically knows whether or not one has won a medal or not. We concede that point. And she said, wow, that's a huge concession, Mr. Libby. And that's exactly right. If you take that argument off the table, if you say that it's not chilling, then, of course, they need to come up with some other justification. The justification usually used by the Ninth Circuit was that there was no actual harm done. But in sort of the more interesting colloquies, I thought, in the oral arguments, both Justice Kennedy and even Justice Breyer said that they don't believe that that's the case. As a matter of fact, Justice Breyer had said that he felt that the purpose, the objective, the honor were all diminished by people claiming to falsely have received these medals. So I found that relatively interesting as well.
Well, now,
To take a slightly different tack and to play devil's advocate here, you're familiar with the old adage that the remedy for bad speech is not less speech, but rather more speech.
Right.
And it's been suggested that perhaps the best response to these false claims of military valor is for the government to be more aggressive in publicizing who has received these decorations, to make that information more accessible, perhaps via a website, so that if someone does go out and make false claims, people will be able to check on them, you know, right from their smartphones, right there in the room. Wouldn't that be a better way to address this problem rather than making speech illegal?
Well, to a certain extent, what you say is accurate. And you know, when I'm not wearing my law hat, I actually work full time trying to outline some of these phony veterans. In fact, I ran an NCAA style pool where I had 64 of the absolute worst of these guys, and I let my readers vote on who was the most ridiculous. So there is something to be said for that. But then you still get into kind of a dual problem where the vast majority of people have no idea how to look it up. For instance, the Medal of Honor is already available online. You can look up Medal of Honor recipients simply by Googling their name.
Mm-hmm.
But that actually hasn't really cut down on the number of Medal of Honor recipients. Or those falsely claiming to be Medal of Honor recipients.
Really? So people are still doing that, even though it's easy to point out that they're lying.
Well, yeah, Alvarez himself was claiming I was a Medal of Honor recipient, and this was just a few short years ago, and that much was he'd never actually even served. And the other problem we have is that a lot of times these phonies will do things like they change their names, like Rick Stranloff has done. Rick Stranloff started out as Rick Stranloff, and then he got busted for a fraud in Reno, Nevada, dealing with racing, and he became Rick Duncan, the decorated war hero. Mm. And once we busted Rick Duncan, he became Rick Gold, an attorney in Denver. And some of these guys are very hard to track down. On the other side, we are arguing also, the American Legion has been arguing for updating some of these websites, because right now it usually takes us 2 to 3 months to get the records back on an individual. Now, if someone claims to be an Iraq war veteran, we generally have a little bit more access because the stuff is fresh. But, of course, the National Personnel Records Commission in St. Louis hasn't managed to put all the records online, so it takes some time. And again, it's very difficult to search these people out, which is why even just as recently as this last month, we had a PTSD counselor who was providing mental health training and things of that nature. And it turned out that his entire story had been based on a false military narrative as well.
Wow.
So we run into the problem a lot, and it really does seem to be proliferating. Is there an argument to be made by more speech? Absolutely. I certainly understand that. The problem is that, again, it's going to be very, very difficult to use that to come to a level where we can actually have some belief that that the people are accurate in what they're saying.
It's your weekly constitutional, and we're discussing the Stolen Valor Act with Mark Seavey, a combat veteran currently with the American Legion. Stay tuned. She's back. Kelly Carmichael is back. And I bet, I'm just going to guess, that she's going to tell me what's happening this week at Montpelier.
Yeah, we have a new exciting tour, kind of a VIP experience for folks to come to our sunset tours of Montpelier.
Oh, man, I can just see it.
Sitting on the steps of James and Dolly Madison's home, looking at the Blue Ridge Mountains.
That
14
is,
miles away.
That, you know, and the thing is, on a clear day, I bet that would just be, I have not seen a sunset from the front porch.
It
that
really
would be
is spectacular. Yeah, It's really spectacular. It's worth going and joining our Facebook pages, either Montpelier or Center for the Constitution Facebook pages, because throughout the summer we always post photos when the staff is enjoying it.
What does one have to do to become a VIP?
Well, go to montpelier.org so you can get a ticket, and the tour itself will include after-hours lecture of the Constitution and the House, wine and cheese reception, the sunset tour, all with some of our Montpelier executive team.
I see. That absolutely sounds wonderful. And is wine included?
There is wine included.
There is wine.
So I know you'll be there.
I would definitely like to be there. That's tremendous. And so there's a constitutional aspect of this. There's the tour itself. And then there's just the enjoyment. Tremendous. Now, if it rains and you can't see the sunset, so you get a refund, right?
I don't know about that. You'll have to go to Montpelier.org for the fine print.
I see.
But I tell you one thing. Even when it's raining, it is still a squirrel's leap from heaven at Montpelier.
A squirrel's leap from heaven at Montpelier. So go to Montpelier.org or center.montpelier.org, and you can get information on these things. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm discussing the Stolen Valor Act with Mark Seavey of the American Legion. Well, you've mentioned the word fraud several times here as well, and as you know, fraud is something that is already penalized under the law.
Sure.
Certainly many of the circumstances you've described, certainly if people are soliciting money fraudulently, that's already illegal. We already penalize that type of speech. So is the Stolen Valor Act really necessary, or is it redundant?
Well, it is necessary. In the case of someone who, for instance, might be asked to be a speaker at a Veterans Day ceremony or something of that nature, the material benefit that he gets is not necessarily a tangible one. In other words, he's not getting an honorarium or something. They'll usually use it sort of as a Ponzi scheme where, they'll appear before a body and they'll speak, and that kind of puffs them up in the community, and they get the various accolades and things of that nature, and then they move on. Now, if the Supreme Court rules against the Stolen Valor Act, which I guess I used to think was about an 80% chance, after hearing the oral arguments, I'd say it's about 50-50. But the House and the Senate already have clarifying language in, which would take stolen valor and create a fraud element, a mens rea for the act itself. So that may be where we're headed either way. Now, I do think that they're slightly different. And I think that one of the more important elements is the harm element, which the Ninth Circuit has said they don't see it as harming. The Tenth Circuit said, well, certainly it's harming. And then the Supreme Court seems to be agreeing. So that's another one of those things. When you don't have a definitive victim, it can be difficult. Now, I know there are some people who have resorted to civil lawsuits recently. There's a gentleman who runs a SEAL training facility. It's a private facility, but it's run by SEALs and everything. It's called the SEAL Training Experience or something. And he's taken the rather extraordinary measure of actually suing these people in civil court because they're damaging the potential of his business.
Hmm.
And I think that might be a bit of a stretch, but it does bring all these things into focus.
All right. Well, you mentioned your efforts to publicize these fraudulent claims of military service or military valor, and you also mentioned that you've had awards for the most ridiculous. Well, what are some of the most ridiculous claims that you've heard?
That would probably be, there was a Michael Patrick McManus who was down in Houston, Texas, and he was claiming to have been, he had shown up at a political event wearing his medals, and he had claimed to be the youngest brigadier general in the history of the United States Army. But what made him particularly humorous to us was the fact that he was wearing an SAS pin from Great Britain and an Order of the British Empire around his neck.
wearing British decorations and insignia.
Yeah, and we find that fairly often. We busted one earlier this week who was a gentleman wearing a Marine dress uniform, and he had 5 Purple Heart ribbons affixed to his chest. But of course, when you get numerous awards, you get a cluster, an oak leaf cluster on top of the one ribbon. You don't wear them all parallel to each other. So
I see.
He was also relatively funny. And then we've had another another guy who showed up at his son's graduation from basic training wearing an Air Force uniform, but which had all of the insignia of U.S. infantrymen. So we run into quite a few of them, and they're almost always immediately farcical to look upon. It's the ones that are, you know, that are less clear, like a guy who was soliciting donations for Toys for Tots while wearing a Marine uniform, and it turned out he had never served in the Marine Corps or anything. Those ones are sometimes more difficult to catch, but when we get the big ones, it's fairly obvious right from the jump street.
You know, it reminds me of that scene, perhaps you've seen it in the old movie Trading Places.
Of course, yes.
Yes, and where Eddie Murphy was fraudulently begging and claiming to have lost his legs in military service, and he gave a rather ridiculous account of that as well. But unfortunately for him, he came across a couple of cops who were veterans.
Well, you know, what's kind of, we talk about that case all the time, Agent Orange and everything. We think that's pretty funny, but...
Yeah, that was my name, Agent Orange. I was Agent Orange.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that. It was a good scene.
And Rick Strandloff Duncan out in Colorado had claimed that he had had a finger shot off in the Battle of Fallujah, and he had a metal plate in his head, which was somewhat incongruous with the fact that he had 10 digits on his finger, and even though he had a high-end pipe, there was no scar on his head.
Wait a second. So he said, I got a finger shot off, and he's got all 10 fingers.
Yeah, and
I'm sorry. I know this gets serious, but sometimes they are laughable, aren't they?
To me, it's entirely laughable. The problem with him was that he was actually doing campaign videos for people who were running for Congress. He was actually a spokesperson for a number of veterans organizations out there. And when my people saw him, they immediately knew he was a fake. But there, you know, when you start seeing these guys in campaign commercials and everything else, you know, it begs the question, how many combat veterans do you have around that they couldn't count to 10 to realize that this guy didn't have a finger shot off?
Yeah.
And it's quite ridiculous at times, but to me it is very funny when you run into these guys. It's a serious problem, but you can't help but laugh when you realize how phony they really are.
Well, Mark, the ultimate question in this case I'm going to ask you is not a legal one, but a much more general one. Why? Why are these people doing this? I mean, especially when their claims are so outrageous and so likely to subject them to ridicule down the road.
You know, we've talked a lot about this, and those of us in the Stolen Valor community have come to basically two sort of realizations. The first is that the world is becoming more instant gratification and, you know, less basically family and more what your prestige is within the community. So I think there's that sort of cultural underpinning that everybody wants to, you know, push further. Back in Vietnam, clearly there weren't as many people lying about being veterans because it wasn't looked on in the same way back then. It should have been looked on the same way, but it wasn't. Now, today, the Vietnam veterans have said, we're not going to allow that to happen to the current generation. And so military service is viewed as something that's laudable, something that's admirable and honorable. And I think people who aren't a part of that community want to be in that community. And the second part of that is the fact that with today's technology, it's simply a lot easier to find these guys. We don't go 2 days without getting a new Facebook picture sent to us that says, take a look at this guy. And for most of us that have spent some time doing this, you can spot a phony inside of seconds merely because you just know the way the ribbons go. If you have a Marine Corps uniform, you're not going to have an Army Combat Infantry badge on it. If you're in the Air Force, you're not going to have a Army EOD ribbon on it. And these things are obvious to the rest of us, but when you only have 1% of the population that's, you know, served in the military, it makes it a little bit more difficult for some of the civilians to catch on to these things.
Yes, it does. And in fact, I misspoke a moment ago. I said that was my ultimate question, but I actually have one more. Do you recall a case from perhaps 10 or 15 years ago where a very high-ranking military officer, I think he was an admiral,
It was Admiral Borda.
Yeah, Admiral Borda, who was highly decorated, highly respected, had unquestionably distinguished himself throughout a long military career. And yet someone pointed out, after seeing a photograph of him, that perhaps he was inappropriately wearing one particular decoration. And could you comment on that?
That was right when I had started. That was actually right when I joined the military. And
What year was that, if I may ask?
I think it was around 90, maybe 94.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Okay.
And the real sad thing about that was that, Admiral Borda was an absolutely honorable guy, and I don't know exactly what went into this mistake, but he obviously took it far more seriously than others had. It appears he died in 96, so...
Okay, well, hold on. Before we get to the end of it, someone pointed out that he had a decoration on there that indicated, you know, that he had served someplace or maybe in combat when he hadn't.
Right. It was even more than that. He had served in combat, too. He had added a V device to one of his ribbons. I think it was the Bronze Star ribbon, but I'm not positive on that, but... The V device means that it was for valor. Now, you can get a Bronze Star for service, which is doing something above and beyond in a service function, or you can get it with a V device, which means for valor, which means that it was in combat. So you saved lives or you managed to fight your way through encirclement or something of that nature. Mm-hmm. And apparently he had added a V device to the ribbon that he wasn't authorized, and that was the only thing that was wrong on his entire rack of medals. But that
and he had a bunch of them. He had a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And to the casual observer, this would have appeared minor. Obviously, it had significance. One wonders why he simply didn't say, "Well, I'm sorry, I made a mistake."
Well, I think that's part and parcel with the military mentality that's. There are mistakes you make, and there are mistakes you don't make. And trying to take the valor of someone who actually was there, who fought in that, is one of those things you don't do. And I think, for all whatever demons Admiral Borda was wrestling with or whatever, he was an honorable man. And this cuts right to the heart of what being honorable is all about. And he simply couldn't live with that.
And he took his own life.
And he took his own life.
And that was tragic, of course, but I think it really does underscore your position and how seriously people like you, people in the military, people who have served in dangerous circumstances, how very seriously they take this issue. So I hate to end on a sad note, but I think that illustrates your circumstance or your position fairly well. Anything you'd care to add before we finish?
No, I just, it was interesting when I went to the Supreme Court. I took a buddy of mine with me who was a bona fide hero in my unit, and I spoke with many of the other lawyers that were standing in line waiting to hear this case, and they passionately believed that the Supreme Court should strike this law down just as passionately as I believe they should uphold it. But we had that discussion just as lawyers are off to do. But my buddy who had served in the military, just he couldn't understand how we could get along on this issue, that this was an issue that he believed so vehemently in that he just could not say a kind word to these other attorneys who were standing there. And I kind of understand his mentality. He earned something that 99.9% of America has never earned, and that was his, and he was going to keep it. And to him, it was absolute theft when someone else claimed it. So, being a lawyer, being a soldier, I kind of see both sides, but I have to agree with him.
Well, Mark Seavey of the American Legion, thank you so much for your time. Once again, thank you for your service, and best of luck when you go back to Afghanistan next week.
Tomorrow, in a courtroom in California, a public official is going to answer charges that he fabricated an extraordinary military record.
Who's that? What you want?
Police. We've had some complaints about con men pretending to be blind and crippled.
Oh, I'd love to help you, man, but I ain't seen nothing since I stepped on that landmine in Viet Cong back in 72. It was rough, very painful.
You were in Nam? So were we. Where?
I was in Sang Bang, Dangong. I was all over that place, basically. A lot of places.
What unit were you in?
I was with the Green Beret, Special Unit Battalion's Commando Airborne Tactics, Specialist Tactics Unit Battalion. Yeah, it was real hush-hush. I was Agent Orange, that was my name, Agent Orange, Special Agent Orange, that was me.
Airborne, huh?
I can see! I can see! I have legs! Oh, shit, look at this! Man, I can walk! Jesus! Praise Jesus! I appreciate this. Oh, this is beautiful. I can't believe. Thank you. I just don't know what to do. Glory be to God. Praise Jesus. Look at me. This is too much. I can't believe it. I am beautiful. This is, I can't thank you. First Moses, now this. God, Jesus.
Thanks very much to Agent Orange of Philadelphia, also known as comic genius Eddie Murphy in the movie Trading Places. Well, I'm so glad we have just a little bit of time left because I want to share with you a little conversation I had with another attorney. His name is Bill Turner. Too many accomplishments to list, but I noticed Bill's piece in the New York Times back in February of 2012, and I asked him the $64,000 question in this case. Why does it not make sense simply to say the Constitution doesn't protect lies?
Well, the government acknowledges now that some false speech needs to be protected in order to protect speech that matters, truthful speech that matters. For example, in the hurly-burly of political debate and the rough-and-tumble, robust public discourse we have about politics and so on, the Supreme Court has recognized that error is inevitable, that there will be some false speech, and it shouldn't be punishable, else speakers will steer clear of the prohibited zone and not risk saying something that might later turn out to be false. When they don't have to be able to prove under penalty of going to jail that every detail of what they say is true. So the Supreme Court has given breathing space even for false speech and won't treat it, and never has treated it, as a category of speech that doesn't have any First Amendment protection.
And that's because we're afraid we're going to chill some truthful speech,
exactly,
or some valuable speech, and
exactly,
we want to have the wide open, robust debate. And I think the example you mentioned in your op-ed piece was the Marco Rubio case out of Florida.
Well, that's one example, yeah, mm-hmm, where he represented on his official Senate biography that his parents emigrated from Cuba, escaped from Cuba after the revolution to flee Castro and communism, where the truth is that they came 3 years before the Cuban Revolution. So he's misrepresented that in his official Senate biography. Should that be a crime? I don't think so.
Right, and he of course insists it was an honest mistake, and perhaps it was, who knows, but if a politician or anybody who's talking about politics or about any other important subject feels like he has to be able to document every single statement he makes, then the court is rightly concerned that we're going to chill all kinds of speech. People just won't say anything.
Right.
Because they'll be afraid of going to jail. And that's our show on the Stolen Valor Act. I'd like to thank very much Attorney William Turner from San Francisco, who shared with us his insights from his New York Times op-ed piece. I'd also like to thank Mark Seavey of the American Legion and Ken Paulson of the First Amendment Center. My name is Stuart Harris, my executive producer is Wayne Winkler, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.